welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. And great to have you guys on board. What I want to talk about today is all of this very, very negative stuff going on in the media at the moment. You know, the mining boom is busted and China's going down the tube and Greece is going down the tube and Italy's going down the tube and what else have we got? Oh, America. Well, it's already down the tube and unlikely to be able to climb out of the tube for a long time. Oh my goodness, it's all gloom and doom. What I actually like to talk about first up is the fact that we need to understand the media angle. Now, this is not a derogative comment by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, from a purely idealistic perspective, the media is there to report the facts and inform people, and they have this wonderful, noble job to do. But the business side, and I am an accountant and I am economist and perhaps a little cynical, but the business side of the media is about selling advertising. And let's face it, advertising, the only way to sell advertising is to get readers or listeners or viewers, whichever kind of media we happen to be talking about. And in order to do that, we need to be sensationalistic and really hone in on the bad news, I guess, because bad news sells and good news doesn't, basically. So that being said, what I'd like to do is set some of the records straight on what's actually going on with respect to property in Australia, and in particular, the property in some of the mining-related areas. Now, in order to understand what's going on at a resource sector, what we first of all need to do is understand the ore bodies, I think, more than anything else, and then how they interrelate around the world. Now, just before I get on to that, let me just make a few comments regarding things like Europe as an example. All right, what goes on in Europe from a GDP perspective, a gross domestic product perspective, has actually very little impact on what goes on here in Australia from a housing perspective. Now, I'm not making any comment about the stock market or, you know, how much it jumps around and has its little jitters and whatever else. I have no interest in that. What I'm talking about here is the property market. And in order to have an effect on the property market, what we're really talking about is the monetary system. We're talking about the balance of trade that Australia has with the international markets, where our currency sits and therefore where our interest rates sit, inflation and all of those other factors, jobs mainly, because all of those bigger factors that I just talked about then, what they affect is jobs. Jobs affect housing, housing affects investors. So that's kind of the chain of command, if you like, that I'm going to address. Let's start with Europe. Regardless of what might happen over there, Australia trades very little with Europe. On top of that, we also have a balance of trade that has not really been affected by what's gone on in Europe one iota. The main effect that is going to come out of Europe and what happens over there is the monetary policy, and we need to understand what that actually does. I mean, if Europe's over there propping itself up and doing all of the, you know, all of its little dances inside the euro itself, what that means basically for us is that there's less money on the international monetary system, international monetary market. So what that means is that it's as there's less supply, just as in any demand and supply curves, when there's less supply, the price goes up. Now, when we're talking about the price of money, we're talking about the wholesale price at which our Australian banks borrow and then re-lend to us here in Australia. So it causes a loosening or a contracting of our funding, our banking, our monetary policy here in Australia. Well, all that being said, yes, what goes on in Europe will mean that there will be less money on the open market for international borrowing, which includes our banks. But what it also means is that all the Reserve Bank equivalents all around the world, what they then try and do is they then adjust their levels so that you know, it has a less of an impact internally within their shores. Now, Australia's wholesale rate runs at around about 3.5% at the moment. So the Reserve Bank of Australia has a lot of cushion to be able to lower that, you know, lower that wholesale rate in order to cushion any effect by the higher price of funds on an international basis. So compare that, I suppose, to a country like Japan or to America for that matter. Now, both of those countries have a wholesale rate of about 0.5%. Now, seriously, 0.5% leaves those reserve banks, although they're not called that in the other countries, nowhere to go. There's no cushioning effect. There's nothing that they can do to ease the effect of a tighter monetary policy. So from an Australian perspective, yes, it has a minor impact from a monetary availability markets, but when it really comes down to it, the Australian Reserve Bank of Australia has plenty of room to cushion the effect. And actually what we're doing, because our interest rates are so high, we actually have the other effect of more money coming in on an overnight basis and short-term lending and things like that to be able to be relent within Australia potentially. So we're getting a lot of international money coming in from a capital safe haven perspective. Okay, so now let's have a look at the United States. Whilst we do have a balance of trade with the United States, it's interesting to consider the last few years and how our balance of trade with the United States has actually been affected by the GFC. Now, you would think that with the GFC going on in America, our exports to America would have significantly gone down. Well, here's the drum. No, they haven't. In fact, they haven't changed one iota. The levels of trade going through to the United States are the same as what they've been prior to the GFC. So even though America's gone through one of the worst recessions it's had in the last 70 years, it really hasn't affected Australia and our impact, our interaction with America. So there again, how does that affect our Australian property market? Very little, very little. Okay, now let's talk about Asia. Well, the two fastest growing countries in the world are China and India. Neither of them are interdependent on each other, which means that, you know, they both move in their own cycles and neither is influenced by the other to any large extent. However, both countries have a major influence on Australia because we are the resource bowl of Asia. I mean, we are Asia. We are located in Asia. We deal with Asia. And, you know, we are the closest quarry pit. We are the closest food bowl. We are the closest trading partner of all the raw materials to go into Asia, where they can use all of their cheap labour force and lower cost of living and all of those other things to produce secondary items. So there's a little bit of talk in the media about the fact that, you know, places like China and India will be affected by Europe and the United States because they won't be buying as much from China and India. Well, let's also look at the internal growth in both countries. The urbanisation that's going on in China and India separately from each other is absolutely massive. Do you know how many cars or what percentage of the Chinese population actually drive cars? At the moment, it's a little over 2%. And the expectation is that over the next 5 years, they want to get it up to 5%. And over the next, 7 to 8 years, they want to get it up to 10%. Now, that's a lot of cars. That's a lot of electricity where they're going to need our coal. That's a lot of our LNG, and I'll get to that in a minute. Or it's a lot of steel and iron ore from us to make those cars. That's just cars. Let me give you some statistics here. It was announced even as late as last week that China has just launched a 1 trillion yuan, which is their currency, which equates to, in Australian dollars, about $152.5 billion package on 55 infrastructure projects. Now, that's a lot of money, and it's a lot of development, and it's a lot of steel, and it's a lot of electricity, and all of the things that are needed to make that happen. And, I mean, the infrastructure projects that were actually announced ranged from everything from subways to highways to you know, government buildings and all of that kind of stuff. So, it was a lot of money is going to be poured out there. On top of that, we've also seen that the inventory stockpiles, particularly in iron ore, that the Chinese steel mills were actually running up over the last few months, has pretty much depleted now, which again is going to push the price for coking coal prices particularly up. And even though the commodity prices right now are in a bit of a lull, what we're going to see is that they'll start to pick up as those inventories start to diminish, and they are diminishing. The Chinese authorities are actually also closing their 625 of their coal mines in China due to safety concerns. Now, that may only be a temporary measure, but again, what it means is that we're going to see a much, much greater demand for our coal, whether that's coking coal or brown coal. Now, coking coal is the type of coal that's used to make steel, and brown coal is the coal that is used to fire power stations. It's interesting, even when you start even looking at the economic reports. Now, I'm not a big believer in some of the reports that have come out by the banks, because they quite often get it wrong. But it was interesting to read that ANZ's released some figures in the last few weeks, that they expect to see the coking coal prices back up to $175 a ton, because at the moment it's down, you know, close to the 100, by the end of this year, and that by the middle of next year, being 2013, they expect to see it over $200 a ton. Now, as I say, I read a lot of this economic data, and even though they do get it wrong quite a bit, it was interesting to see that these particular statistics were backed up by some American coal mining statistics that came out. And this is put out, and these are statistics that have been commissioned by major coal industry groups in America to try and work out, you know, how they should be spending their money and what projects should go ahead and things like that. So this information is being used to make major decisions. So you'd think, you know, a fair bit of money's gone into preparing things. And they're actually saying that they expect the coking coal prices to recover to $215 a tonne by the middle of 2013. Now, all of that is very good for Australia. It's very good for the whole industry when we talk about coal, but resources generally. And I'll get onto the respective ore bodies in a minute. But I just want to point out another thing to you, that when we talk about America and the stimulus packages that are going on over there, see, America can't change their reserve rates, because they're already down at 0.5%. So there's no movement there to go. They can't increase demand, internal demand and capacity, by importing or bringing in more immigrants, because they're already at capacity and they've got massive unemployment. And our unemployment figures are very, very low in comparison. So their only opportunity to stimulate the economy over there is actually to print money. And that's exactly what they're doing. And they're going through their third phase of printing money at the moment. And at the moment, they're actually printing about $40 billion US dollars a month. Can you believe that? That's a lot of money to be printing, isn't it? Now, that will mean probably a decrease in the US dollar to some extent, but traditionally, whenever you look at the US dollar going down or any instability coming out of the US, what it means is that all prices go up, because the money flows to what is deemed to be a safe haven. And guess what? Australia is seen to be the quarry pit of the world, basically. So again, with that, you know, increasing in pricing all ore bodies will mean a much, much greater time ahead for all of the real estate that flows on from any of the mining industry. Now, we're not just talking the mining towns. We're talking the mining towns. We're talking the regional towns that are a flow on for everything from bread, milk, and taxi services that surround the mining areas, right through to the ports, and then because a lot of these places, particularly in WA, are fly in, fly out, predominantly fly in, fly out, it brings more money back to wherever those people live. So it really is being spread around Australia actually quite well. Some areas more than others, obviously, but we're starting to see that that flow-on effect really taking, getting some legs right around Australia. There are some weak points, but it's good times ahead. Certainly nothing to be concerned about when you start reading the stuff in the newspapers. Remember what I did say in the beginning about the fact that they need a sensationalistic headline in simply to get a reader or a viewer or a listener in order to be able to sell advertising. And that's how they make money. Without selling advertising, they don't exist. So call me cynical, as I said, but that's the reality of it. Okay, let's talk about ore bodies. Now, when it comes to ore bodies, you really need to understand how the ore bodies work and the projects that are already underway around all of these ore bodies. I guess the major media concern over what's happened in the last, I suppose, 3 months, I suppose, 6 months maybe, have been things like in Queensland, the state government, the new state government up here, has started to impose coal taxes and mining taxes on the majors up here. We've got the federal mining tax. We've got the carbon tax. How many more taxes do we actually need? I guess what you have to understand is that a lot of the reports and even the posturing, if you like, that's going on at a mining company level, there's some other things playing behind the scenes. One is industrial relations. The other is a bit of a political show of feathers against all of these taxes and other bits and pieces. And none of that's going to change. I mean, it's been going on for 100 years, so it's not going to change. You kind of have to read through the figures there to really understand what's going on. Let's talk coal for starters. And really, when we talk coal, the major states that are affected are Queensland first, and then to a lesser extent, New South Wales. And even if we look at the figures that come out of Queensland alone, there's about 104 coal operations around Australia, and there's 60 of those that are in Queensland. So when you take into account the announcements by BHP that they're closing three of them, When you put it into perspective, I mean, get real, guys. There's 60 in Queensland and they're closing three. So, and the three that they're closing were all ones that were tipped for imminent closure anyway. They were the ones that were less productive and less profitable and, all reserves were getting to that non-profitable figure. So it's to be expected, really. When we look from a job loss perspective, it totaled, for Queensland, the announcements totaled a job losses of about 1,300 people. Now, in Queensland alone, now these are only 2011 figures, I'm sorry, I haven't got any more up-to-date figures, but in 2011, and there's a lot more now, there were 27,000 people employed in Queensland mining industry. So if we take off 1,300, it's less than 5%. So the overall impact is not great, yet the media blew it up to be that the whole industry is going to pot and it's going to be all gloom and doom forever. You've also got to remember that there have been mines that have opened up in the last 3 years as well. And of those mines that have opened up just in the last 3 years, they employ another 2,000 construction workers and some 1,200 operational workers. So, the figures are really in the favour of good times ahead, not the other way around. In fact, if you look over the last 5 years, 5 years ago, in the coal mining industry in Queensland alone employed 18,000 200 workers. Now, today, or in 2011 at least, we employed 27,600 to be precise. So, yes, it has increased, and it's actually increased since those figures were released. But that's a 52% increase in the last 5 years. The fact is that the world will still need coal, whether it be for coking coal to make steel or whether it be the brown coal to fire power stations. And when you look at the overall numbers and volume of contracts and requirements around the world, our volume is going to increase over the next 20 years, not decrease. If you look at India, for example, in the last year, they built 24 new coal-fired power stations. And the expectation is that next year, they've already got in the planning, another 35 are going to be built. Now, that's 35 new plants, 24 this year. That's a lot of coal for a lot of years to come. China is operating 75 coal-fired power stations, and you know within the US there's some 600 coal-fired power stations, just to give you some dynamics. Now, we don't sell much to the US because they get their own, like they use their own, so you know, you look at a country the size of China and the number of people there compared to, as an example, America, and they've got 600 over there, and China, you know, with much, much less, 75 or whatever I said, that really shows you the capacity of China to expand as it urbanises, and the push is definitely for coal-fired power stations at least for the next 10 years, probably 20, even though, yes, you do have the green movement that talks about alternate energies, and hey, look, I'm all for it. The practicality of it, that it's just not, the volume is just not going to be there. The ability to be able to, you know, to convert across to an alternative source quickly enough is just not going to be there in the next, I would say, at least 10, probably 20 years. The other energy source, which is quite major and will be a major influence in the future, is going to be LNG, or liquefied natural gas. And again, Queensland's the big winner there. New South Wales is in there as well. And so too is WA. Now, a lot of the LNG for WA is offshore, which means that the royalties don't make it to the local area, but it goes to the federal government. But still, from an export perspective, it's a fabulous thing for the country. Let's just have a look at some of the projects that are underway and the expectation for those projects over the next few years when we start talking LNG. I'm very excited about LNG and all of the runoff towns and all of the infrastructure towns and everything else that support the any of the LNG projects, because what we're going to be seeing is it will be at least the third biggest exporter for Australia within a very short space of time. And the other thing I absolutely love about LNG is that the contracts are actually locked in for 20 years. So we've got contracts with places like, you know, Japan and Korea and, you know, countries mainly all through Asia and China and India and all the rest as well. But we have contracts with them that are locked in, and they span over the next 20 years. And it's Australia who now has to deliver. And when you look at the volumes that Australia has to deliver just to fulfil those contracts, it's enormous. And the capacity, you know, the operations and the wells and the people and the employment and all of those other things and the housing that all of these people have to go into is going to have a major, major impact on anything that is associated with any towns that are associated with LNG. When you look at volumes in places like the Surat Basin and, you know, the drilling that goes on there. And the Surat isn't the only place where, you know, LNG is very prominent, as I said. A lot of New South Wales is going to have some major flow-on effect, and so too will, you know, in and around the Karratha area over there and north of that as well in WA. But just in the Surat Basin alone, there are 63 billion, get that, billion LNG projects currently under construction throughout the Surat Basin. Now, that's a lot of money to be poured into one small area, and everything else that means from a jobs perspective. When we look at an ore body like iron ore, the size and volume and the impact of iron ore and what it has on the Australian economy is massive, not just for the Pilbara. I mean, get this, the GDP of the Pilbara, okay, this is the gross domestic product of the Pilbara area alone, is greater than 125 countries around the world, including New Zealand. Isn't that amazing? The Pilbara area has a GDP of greater than New Zealand. Now, that surely speaks volumes for the size and the strength of iron ore and what it means to Australia. When you start looking at iron ore, WA walks all over everywhere else. I mean, there's minor deposits in other places, but the Pilbara area really is the big winner there. And whilst BHP again has come out and talked about the closure of the Port Hedland expansion or and that sort of thing, or the deferring of the Port Hedland expansion, whilst that may have an impact from a media perspective, what we're really seeing is that the volumes to be put out through Port Hedland alone are actually scheduled to increase. When you look at, BHP, Fortescue, Hancock, Atlas, they all have plans to not only reach the targets of this year, and through Port Hedland alone, they exported 247 metric ton out of Port Hedland. So as a port area, that's a lot of work. And having been there, quite a few times myself, you see the ships lined up, in the waiting to come into the port to take the iron ore away. You've got trains that are literally kilometres and kilometres and kilometres long. But let me get back to the story. The major companies that I mentioned there before, they have plans to see what's now being exported out of Port Hedland of 247 metric ton increased to 495 metric ton over the next 5 years. Now, that's over 100% increase. So regardless of whether they're going to ship it out of the existing port facilities or whether there's going to be an expansion required, just even if they only get half that, because the volumes have to increase because they're there, the contracts, and that's what we have to fulfil. And you look at the requirements and the demands coming out of particularly just the Asian region, you're starting to see major flow-on effects from a housing perspective. The Chinese steel production is expected to increase by 40% through to 2025, simply taking up that urbanisation of China internally. Nothing to do about with exports to Europe or America or anywhere else. That's just internal urbanisation. And it's the Pilbara that underpins that. So, your major centres, your port towns, you're simply not going to see them pull back. Even the towns where most of the processing is done, like Newman and places like that, they're still going to remain strong for a very long time. And whilst you may see some minor movements in employment and things like that, it's going to be redirected into other areas rather than being cut completely. It's just a movement amongst the industry itself. And the Pilbara, whilst it's a large area, it's all driven by the same economic forces. What we are going to see that'll have a direct impact on housing and house prices in the Pilbara is more to do with the financing industry than anything else. It's not about, jobs or exports or any of the things that you would think, and that's what the media is reporting on. What's actually going to affect prices generally? Now, this is house prices in the Pilbara. It's house prices in the Surat Basin, the Bowen Basin, the port towns, the runoff towns, everywhere is actually the ability to be able to get funding for projects in those areas, because the banks in particular, you know, they've got a little bit of the jitters, they've got a reason to pull back and be a little more conservative, which they don't take much of a reason, believe me. So what you're going to see is a lot of the projects will actually be stalled for a while until confidence comes back, and that alone will mean that supply won't be getting out onto the market as easily and freely. You're going to see a tightening of supply. Demand is going to go up, not down. So what's going to happen, of course, is prices will go up. Rents will go up, prices will go up. You're going to see a little bit of a lull. But I can tell you now, those investors that hang on in these areas are going to be the winners. Those who have short-term rental problems in some areas right now, if you can hang on, you're going to do much, much better. The prices will stabilise in some areas, but they in other areas they'll actually increase, particularly in some of the stronger port towns, and also in the runoff towns and some of the mine site towns as well. Those that haven't gone through massive increases yet. So it's good times ahead, basically. Stop listening to the fear mongering. Look at the core figures, and just have a look at the volumes and the contracts in place for the volumes that is going to be required over the next number of years for the major ore bodies, being iron ore, coal and LNG, particularly LNG. You start to have a look at the tonnages to go out of the ports and the expectation for increase there. There was a recent study commissioned by the Queensland Resource Council, which identified the potential for a threefold increase this decade in coal output in Queensland alone. And that's being multiplied right around the country in New South Wales and in WA. I mean, I guess the losers are going to be the other states. They're going to be Victoria, because it's heavily manufacturing. It's going to be South Australia, unfortunately, because of the stigma around uranium and Olympic Dam, and the fact that Olympic Dam is not going, the expansion of it's not going ahead as planned. And that's a bad thing for South Australia, because it would have made a massive difference down there. But, you know, that's a uranium as opposed to iron ore or coal thing. And it really is to be expected. But this commission that was put out by the Queensland Resource Council, it was resulting in increases in export shipments from 210 million tonnes last year, that's 2011, to just over 700 million tonnes by 2020. So from 210 million tonnes exported last calendar year, it's expected to increase by 2020 to 700 million tonnes. That's huge. And, you know, even though the future expansion of places like Abbots Point and even Dudgeon Point for that matter, that sheer volume of tonnes going out of there, they're going to need more resources. They're going to need more points. Now, whether the government's ports, I mean, whether the government's going to pay for it or whether the actual companies themselves are going to pay for it is a different story. And I think that's really what's being played out behind the scenes. You know how I love figures. And when you actually, when you chart some of this stuff and you look at, even if commodity prices drop by 50%, when you take into account the increase in volume to meet the supply, it will actually mean that our profitabilities will go up, not down, by a 50% drop in commodity prices. Now, that says a lot for the future of the mining industry generally. And even though we had a few projects canned with BHP, well, they were mines that were going to close anyway. The Port Hedland expansion, they're going to increase capacity there, increase efficiency and productivity before the expansion goes ahead. That's basically what it means. But there are 98 projects worth, these are projects that have already been committed to right around Australia, and predominantly, as I say, again, we're talking Queensland, we're talking New South Wales, and we're talking WA. but there are 98 projects that have already been approved, commissioned, and are definitely proceeding. They're like the money's been set aside, etc. Worth, get this, $260.8 billion. $260.8 billion. So the minor closures of non-profitable mines that was announced in the media, when you put it into perspective with those kind of projects, what that means from jobs, what it means from demand, house prices, rental yields. Guys, it's good times ahead. So stop panicking, stop being a worry wart, and as I say, if you can hang on, if you can get in now, you're going to see some really good rises ahead, as well as increases in yields. It's important to understand what kinds of property to buy, though, because there is a lot of stuff out there where the money has already been made on it, and you're going to sit back and probably not get great returns for a while. So it's important to get yourself educated so you really know how to maximise your yields, undercut the marketers, and get in there and really make some major profits in the industry that are going to go on for decades to come. So guys, that's it from me. Great to talk to you again, and I hope that really puts your mind at ease with respect to what's going on around the place. I know there's a lot of stats in there. Listen to it a couple of times, because you'll really get some great information about the flow-on effect into the housing industry of the resource sector. And I hope to see you again very, very soon at one of my three-day intensives, where I can really show you what to do, what to buy, exactly where to go, and how to come in, 50, 60 grand below everybody else, and have a yield somewhere between, 20 to 40% higher than everybody else. That's the name of the game. It's not just about buying anything. It's about buying the right thing in the right area. So guys, that's it from me. Great to talk to you, and I'll be back again to talk to you very, very soon on something completely different. Bye for now.